You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting on commercial stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations all across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio at every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. Boy, we've got a lot to cover today. Mr. Burns weighs in. He's got a new theory about the fiscal cliff. I've got to share that with you. Bernie Sanders points out something that I am astounded the news media hasn't picked up about John Boehner wanting to take an axe to disabled veterans benefits. And Starbucks in the UK, a note from Nigel, our web, I was going to say sysop, webmaster. We used to call them sysops back in the old CompuServe days when Nigel and I used to work together. But let's start with Mike Papantonio. He's the attorney with and partner with Love and Law and co-host of Ring of Fire Radio with Bobby Kennedy Jr. and Sam Cedar. RingofFireRadio.com, of course, their website. And, Pap, welcome back to the program.
Tom, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better, my friend. And you?
Doing fine, thanks.
Good, good. I'm just astounded by the fact that 25% of the Republicans polled in this public policy poll that was commissioned by Daily Kos, 25% of Republicans want their state to leave the United States.
Right.
I'm guessing you've got a take on this.
Well, I do. You know, this is something that Republicans are desperately trying to run away from, is this whole secession idea. This week we see, and it's going to continue, removing the right wing Republicans from committees, trying to bring some normalcy back to this party. But when you have something like the secession issue out there, it's very difficult to accomplish that, Tom. You have credible conservative newspapers that are trying to suggest, well, this is really nothing. This is just a handful of wing nuts that are out there trying to accomplish this. And it's a problem because I guess for the Republicans right now, they've identified the idea that if they don't just completely rebuild, their chances of extinction are very, very high. So you see this infighting, like we saw with, you know, can you imagine Republican senators attacking Bob Dole, who's up talking about,
in a wheelchair.
In a wheelchair. So what they're trying to do is you have people with a brain, you have rational thinkers within the Republican Party trying to say we have to do something. Now, the secession problem is a big problem because out in Texas, the conservative newspapers, they want to say, well, you know, gee, this isn't really that big of a deal, but it is a big deal.
Yeah, it definitely is. And 38 Republicans.
Yes.
Including Jim DeMint, Mike Lee, Marco Rubio, correct, voted to say that they're not going to go along with the UN treaty that simply mirrors existing American law that was signed into place by George W. Bush. Is it possible that these Republicans in the Senate, this is the Americans with Disability Act, the UN's
right,
decided
right,
this is such a great idea, why don't we go international with it and simply, you know, take the American law and make it a UN treaty. And, it wouldn't have changed the American law at all. Treaties become the law of the land, but we already have it as a law. And, I mean, was this Republicans voting? Rick Santorum got up and said, you know, this is going to lead to abortions or something like that. Never did make sense to me. But is this Republicans just, you know, oppose the Americans with Disabilities Act, and therefore they don't want to see it as a treaty because that makes it more permanent? Or is this just, you know, hey, we are still opposing anything this administration wants.
It is that we are still obstructionist. And here's why, Tom. There's this nightmarish thing. It's a nightmarish fish called a snakehead fish. Now, the reason I tell you this story is because the snakehead fish is the equivalent of the Tea Party. It's what's happening to the Republican Party. The snakehead fish is this sharp, has this sharp shark-like teeth. Yeah, 75,000 eggs it lays a year. It eats virtually everything. It drinks blood. It destroys everything within its reach. The problem is that is what the Tea Party has become to the Republican Party. Now, some people understand the importance of killing the snakehead fish. Others still don't get it. Eric Cantor still doesn't get it. These people, Rubio still doesn't get it. But the people who are rational thinkers are understanding when we have issues like we saw the attack on this very, very distinguished politician and great statesman, Bob Dole. When we see secession being talked about in our red states like Texas and Georgia and Alabama, what it is the snakehead fish is out of control. And that's right now, in the next few weeks, Tom, you're going to see Republicans quietly removing wingnut, really ultra-conservative Republicans from important committees. You're going to see them trying to quietly remove very, right now, influential wingnut right-wing Republicans from party leadership. It's going to happen behind closed doors. We'll probably start seeing the stories next month more than ever. But there's some intelligence, some rational thinking within the Republican Party that says if we don't do this, we will become extinct because the snakehead fish is eating us up.
So Bruce Bartlett might end up replacing Karl Rove on Fox News on the official, you know, on GOP TV.
Well, isn't that a great example? Isn't that a wonderful example? Listen, when Roger Ailes says something ails Fox News, and he says we have to have the little turd blossom moved aside. We have to have crazy man Dick Morris moved aside because it simply is not projecting what we're going to have to project for the Republican Party this next year and the year after that in order to have a chance. In order to have a chance of having,
well, I thought it was really interesting. I don't know if you saw this. I get the trade publications for the talk radio industry, and I don't remember if it was in Talkers or if it was in one of the other ones. But you know, you get a daily email blast. And 3 or 4 days ago, Michael Savage wrote this long op-ed piece, or they quoted him in an interview in one of the radio trades, and this went out to every talk show host in America, saying that if right-wing talk show hosts think that they're going to hold their audience simply by bashing Obama, they're nuts. That it's just not, it doesn't play with the American people anymore.
Yeah, well, that's exactly
that's
right.
Michael Savage.
Well, it is. I mean, to have him saying that, I think what Savage is seeing for a long time, Tom, what the American public and advertisers and people who run these radio stations have been completely fleeced by the Michael Savages and the Rush Limbaughs. For example, Rush Limbaugh has always tried to project that he has this huge, huge audience. He did it one time. But that audience is disappearing because of the things we always talk about, because of demographics change, because of generational changes. But at the same time, they're disappearing because rational thinkers still do occupy the position of Republican voters. Mm. And Republican voters are saying the snakehead fish is eating us up, and if we don't do something about it, we're going to be yesterday's
and
news.
And yet, in the minute we have left here, Pep, Boehner's got a real problem because he's got Eric Cantor, who is in with the Tea Party guys, standing right behind him, the number two guy with a shiv stuck in his left kidney.
Well, exactly right. And he realizes that Cantor now is positioning for a position in 2016.
Right.
And he understands that Cantor represents the divide. Rubio represents the divide. And they're at a loss for trying to find something that fits into that middle that can again make a Republican proud to be Republican instead of being embarrassed.
Although Rubio did come out today and say that the world is 4.5 billion years old.
Yes. Well,
so,
what he really said, I think the quote was, yes, I know how old the earth is. And then when he was pressed, he actually came up with the number.
Yeah. But according to science.
According to science.
Yeah. Amazing. Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com is the website. Pap, it's always great to have you with us. Thank you for sharing.
Thank
you for sharing your thoughts with us today. It's much appreciated. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back with more of my thoughts, your thoughts, the news of the day, paranoid delusions among the Republicans, right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Profoundly paranoid delusions, in fact. You're going to be astounded by the paranoid delusions that are sweeping the Republican Party.
Hit the road, Jack.
Yeah,
that's increasingly the message to Republicans from, or at least the crazies among the Republicans. I'm all in favor of my dad's kind of Republicans. I have no problem with the William F. Buckley, the Dwight Eisenhower Republicans making a comeback. Even the, arguably the Bruce Bartlett and David Frum Republicans. I think that there needs to be a healthy debate in this country, a rational debate. But when the grounding of that debate is whether or not the president was born in Kenya, when the grounding of that debate is whether the president has secret FEMA camps that he's going to lock up all the Republicans in, when the grounding of that debate is whether or not Acorn, which hasn't even existed for 2 years, just stole the 2012 presidential election, it has traveled into the realm of crazy. Just plain old, flat out crazy. And it's not helped by people like Grover Norquist, who are requiring Republicans to sign pledges to say that they place their loyalty to Grover Norquist, a multimillionaire K Street lobbyist who receives more than two-thirds of his funding from just two big foundations sponsored by a small handful of billionaires, you know, the usual suspects, who don't want to see their taxes go up. It doesn't help when people like Grover Norquist are out there, you know, freaking out in public and saying, I've been on this rodeo before. You know, it's a... So we have a new sponsor, by the way. This is where Rocky Mountain Mike put this thing together, actually. This is just great. This is, well, let me just share it with you. This is our new sponsor.
Honey, what is it?
It's that Grover Norquist. I can't sleep.
Oh, him again.
And he called me a poopy head.
Well, here, try this.
Norquil?
Uh-huh.
Norquil, the nighttime sniveling, sleazy, empty-headed, schmucky, weasley, shut the f*** up so we can get something done medicine in liquid or suppository.
Perfect. Norquil. Oh, man. And Mr. Burns. Mr. Burns, of the Simpsons. He has an explanation. He's got this PSA out that, you know, that they're rolling around. And here's his explanation of what the fiscal cliff is, right? It's very simple. It's very straightforward. It's very short. He's standing in front of an upward, you know, going arrow on a graph. And that being the, you know, as we go up the cliff and here's his explanation. It's very straightforward.
Think of the economy as a car and the rich man as the driver. If you don't give the driver all the money, he'll drive you over a cliff. It's just common sense.
There you go. Just think of the economy as a car, and the rich man is the driver. If you don't give him all the money, he'll drive you off the cliff. Yes, that is the Republican strategy. And on top of that, you know, when John Boehner finally said, okay, we are, you know, the president basically said, okay, put up or shut up. You know, you guys, I'll tell you where I want taxes raised. And not only did he tell them, he actually passed legislation in the Senate that does it. Let's raise the taxes on the top 2%. Let's raise the capital gains tax slightly. I mean, take it from 15 up to 20%. Let's raise taxes on working people who earn over $250,000 a year. There's no tax increase on their first $250,000 a year. So for 100% of Americans under the president's plan are not seen a tax increase on their first $250,000. And 98% of Americans don't make more than $250,000. So that's, you know, 98% of Americans see no tax increase whatsoever. And 100% of Americans see no tax increase on their first $250,000. But that 2% who make more than $250,000, they're going to see a 3% more or less, 3.5%. My guess is he's going to compromise it down to 1 or 2 or 3%. We'll see. But, you know, I hope he holds at 3.9%. Tax increase on the taxes. And so, you know, Obama said, here it is. I'll lay it out. I'll tell you exactly what I want to do. Now you tell me what you want to do. And so Boehner comes forward and says, well, you know, we want to voucherize Medicare. He stands behind Paul Ryan's plan to turn Medicare into a voucher system and to raise the eligibility age for Medicare from 65 to 67. Now, these have been, 2 years in a row, the Republicans passed this in the House of Representatives. Didn't go anywhere because the Democrats controlled the Senate and the White House, but they passed it. So they're on record as liking that. You know, let's destroy Medicare, basically. And the Republicans said, let's chain the cost of living index, the cost of living index for Social Security, which is slightly different than the consumer price index, because people, retired people and disabled people tend to buy different things than your average 25-year-old who's out there buying a computer or an iPhone or a Game Boy or whatever. They're more concerned with things like food and medicine and transportation and housing. And so what the Republicans are saying, well, let's take the CPI index, the CPI, and chain it to Social Security. This is called the chained CPI. In other words, let's have Social Security's annual increases be smaller than they are right now. So what will happen is over time, everybody on Social Security will see a cut relative to inflation. Inflation will go up 3%. Social Security only goes up 2%. So you lose 1% a year in Social Security. Over a couple of decades, you've really taken a big bite out of the butt of Social Security. This is the Republicans' plan. What nobody has been reporting is that there is another group whose benefits are tied to the Social Security Cost of Living Index, and that's disabled veterans. Bernie Sanders, he just issued this news release. He said deficits must be reined in, but not by taking away benefits for more than 3 million disabled veterans, many of them injured fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He said the so-called chain CPI applies not only to Social Security recipients, but to disabled veterans as well. And here's a quote from Bernie. He says, it is morally and economically unacceptable that anyone in Congress would propose more tax breaks for millionaires, billionaires, and large corporations, which is what the Republicans are doing, while at the same time proposing significant cuts for disabled veterans. I mean, you talk about hitting them where they live. The Republicans pretend that they are, we're the party of the military. Well, they're the party of defense contractors, but the actual soldiers, not so much. They want to cut their benefits.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So my question isn't, how long is it going to be for veterans to figure this out? I have a feeling they are. How long is it going to be for the corporate media to figure out that this is what the Republicans said and honestly reported?
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
It is so warm here in Washington, D.C. It is 80.4 degrees right now in the studio I'm broadcasting from, because the building is shut off the air conditioning. And we've got several thousand watts of equipment, lights and stuff in here. Typically this time of year, you just crack open the window and it cools right down. It would be like, 40 out or 30, but yesterday was in the 70s. Right now it's in the 60s, I think. It's incredible. What'd you say, Jim? 57, close to the 60s. It's just amazing. So, that global warming stuff is here. Yesterday we reported on how the Port of Los Angeles workers were going out on strike to support the clerical workers. Apparently what was going on was that the clerical workers' jobs, at least many of them, the companies were planning on outsourcing them. The clerical workers doing the bookkeeping, keeping track of the numbers, all that kind of thing. Well, you can do that in India for half the price, right? Not so much, said the longshoreman. And the clerical workers set up a picket line. There wasn't that many of them. And the longshoremen, and there was a lot of them, said, we're not going to cross that picket line. And 10 out of 14 of the docks of the ports in the Port of Los Angeles, the Port of San Diego, got shut down. So the L.A. port workers, the L.A. port has given in and said, okay, we're not going to outsource these jobs. And this is something we should all be looking at as like, oh, okay, we can do this. Harry Reid, by the way, once again said he's going to fix the filibuster. He's going to actually – Jeff Merkley was on this program a week or so ago talking about his strategy, which is like, let's do it the way that they did in the movies. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. You want a filibuster? You got to stand there and talk. And not just theatrically like it historically has been, but actual, this is the actual filibuster. You have to stand there and talk. And let's just do it. And so Reid has got the support of President Obama on this, which is really huge. I mean, that's a big deal in and of itself. And he says that he's got some Republicans with him. He only needs 51 votes. The Senate rule, the Constitution, here's how it works. The Constitution says that the House and Senate, these two bodies, the two legislative bodies, may determine their own rules of operation. Now, the Constitution lays out some, you know, it takes a simple majority of votes for most laws, takes a supermajority of votes for things like treaties, amending the Constitution. I mean, there's, you know, some basic guidelines. But all the hundreds of minutia of when does a bill go into committee, when does it come out of committee, when does debate begin, when does debate end, how do you bring it to the floor for a vote, how is the vote conducted, how can people vote, can they vote president, all that, none of that stuff is in the Constitution. Who's in charge, who decides what happens to what, none of that is in the Constitution. And so there's this book, this body of rules that the House and Senate have that over the last 230 plus years, they've kind of tweaked and fine-tuned and developed to be what they feel comfortable with. And up until President Obama's presidency, the filibuster was not that big a deal. Harry Reid is fond of pointing out that he's been Senate Majority Leader the same number of years as Lyndon Johnson was, and that was back in the era when you had Brown versus Board of Education and busing and civil rights legislation. And in fact, it was 57 or 58, I think, maybe 56, when Strom Thurmond stood up and you know, for 24 hours, 23 hours, and tried to filibuster the civil rights legislation. So Harry Reid points out that in the 6 years that Lyndon Johnson was running the Senate, he only had to deal with, as a Democrat, the Democratic leader of the Senate, he only had to deal with one filibuster. And it was probably that Strom Thurmond one, that famous one. Harry Reid has had to deal with 376 of them, I think it is. Over 370 in any case. And there's, you know, more happening right now as we speak. So the Constitution says that the rules by which the Senate and the House operate are voted on as the first order of business every 2 years when a new Congress is sworn in. And a new Congress, you know, this is the 115th, whatever. I don't know the number, but it's, you know, every 2 years, you take the number of years the country's been around and divide it by two, and that's how many Congresses there are. And the reason for that is because every single member of the House of Representatives is up for re-election every 2 years. And one-third of the Senate is up for re-election every 2 years. So they consider a Congress to be 2 years long. This is also why defense appropriations, military appropriations for everything except the Navy can't be more than 2 years long. We've had that conversation here before. So there's this little window of time, because the first thing, or maybe the second thing. Actually, I think it's probably the first thing. You know, I'm not really sure. Here's where I was going with this. The first thing they vote on is the rules. The second thing they vote on is who is going to be the leader. But I think, actually, maybe they first vote on the leader, because the leader has to introduce the rules. So, in any case, it almost doesn't matter. There is this little window of 5 or 10 minutes on the very beginning of the very first day of the new Congress, which would be, you know, the first week of January after the new year, when the new Congress members are sworn in, and then they all assemble in Congress and they all get together and they vote on the rules. And after that, you're stuck with those rules for 2 years. Now, technically, you can change them. That's the old-fashioned nuclear option. Congress has the right to reestablish its rules. But tradition and arguably law say that you do it every 2 years during that 5-minute window. So Harry Reid is saying, you know, we're going to turn this into a real filibuster. And this is something, you know, and Jeff Merkley has been pushing for this. And Jeff Merkley, a brilliant guy, good progressive, the junior senator from Oregon, and a man I have tremendous respect for. So I, you know, if you have a member of you do, unless you live in Washington, D.C., you have two senators. Call both their offices and say, please support Senator Reid in reforming the filibuster. Because it has been used as a tool of obstruction by the Republican Party for the last 4 years in a way that has really hurt this country. It's one of the reasons employment is still as high as it is. The Republicans didn't want unemployment to go down because then Obama would get reelected. And, you know, Mitch McConnell was quite upfront about it. You know, his goal was to make Obama one-term president. And if he could just screw the economy to do that and have enough people PO'd at the president, because they assume that he's, you know, he has some godlike power, then that would do it. But the Republican delusion, by the way, 49% of Republicans, nearly half, 49% of Republicans believe that Barack Obama didn't actually win the election last month, that it was stolen by Acorn. Acorn is a group that has not existed for 2 years. When they did exist, what they did was they registered voters, mostly, you know, mostly poor and urban and minority voters, but they registered voters. And there were a few people who worked for Acorn who, in an effort to get a paycheck without actually doing the work of knocking on doors and standing out in the open and in the cold and asking people for their signatures and their ID and stuff, there were a few people who just, like, forged signatures. Here's Mickey Mouse. And Acorn themselves turned these people in, busted them. But James O'Keefe and Fox turned this into some sort of, you know, brouhaha, some, oh, that's proof that, you know, look at this, there's a phony voter registration. Well, yeah, Acorn pointed it out. They helped prosecute the people who did it, but that wasn't enough for the Republicans. So they took down Acorn. Acorn went bankrupt 2 years ago. Still 49%, it was 53% of Republicans in 2008 who thought Acorn stole the election for Obama. Acorn was around in 2008. Acorn hasn't been around for 2 years. So how'd they steal the election? Nobody knows, but the Republicans live in this weird little bubble, and it's just, it's very strange. It's very strange. Earl in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Earl, do I have this right that the Michigan State Senate is trying to turn Michigan into a right-to-work-for-less state the way Indiana did?
That's right, Tom. My cell phone has been burning up with emails and text messages saying get to Lansing by 4 o'clock because the lame duck Senate is taking the legislation to the floor at 4 o'clock. I'm asking that any person, working person, union or not, within the sound of my voice, get to Lansing. It's just wrong. 8 out of 10 of the poorest states in this nation are right-to-work-for-less states. Mm-hmm. 9 out of 10 of the poorest educated states in this nation are right-to-work-for-less states. And I don't understand if they need to take on this war. You know, our unions have been working with management.
Yeah, yeah, we lost you, Earl. I think you're, you're still there. Okay.
Yeah, my union.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, Earl. Your cell phone is croaked. But I get the point. I get the point, absolutely. And Michigan has been, you know, historically one of those bastions of unionization, which is why I was able to have a middle-class life with my dad being a college dropout who worked at a tool and die shop for 40 years and was able to raise four boys and own his own house at the end of that 40, at the end of that 40 years, that, you know, when he retired, and you know, own a car and take vacations. And it's like, you know, welcome to the middle class. That's the American dream.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Republicans in the Michigan State Senate want to take down the American dream in the state of Michigan. So get thee to Lansing if you are listening to my voice in Michigan. 4 o'clock vote today.
You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan.
This is a song dedicated to the secessionists coming up in the next hour.
Hop on the bus, Gus.
Yes, indeed. Hop on the bus, Gus. That's what I say to people who want to secede from the union, who want to leave the United States. These 25% of Republicans is, see you later. Good luck. I mean, I'm not sure where they're going to go. They, you know, they want to take, like, Mississippi with them. There's a lot of good Democrats in Mississippi who are saying, nah, I don't think so. We don't have any red states. We don't have, there's not a single state in the union that voted 100% Republican. I don't think there's a single state in the union that voted 60% Republican. Maybe. But they're few and far between. Most states are purple. there are good Democrats and good progressives and good Greens and, you know, all that kind of, and there are some reasonable Republicans, some crazy Republicans, some Tea Party Republicans, some flat out crazy libertarians, Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. You've got that whole spectrum. So, Bill in Clifton, New Jersey, you have a new word for the dictionary, really?
Yeah, that, and I had a title for your book, if you'd like.
Okay.
One of the smartest things I ever heard you say when you were arguing with some right-wing crazy was, not everyone wants to be a millionaire. And that struck a chord with me really big. You know, it still does. And in terms of a word, a Norquestian oath, which, unlike a Faustian bargain in which somebody gets screwed but both parties gain something, in a Norquestian oath, both parties lose. One party loses money, one party loses morality.
And the country loses, too. The country goes
right.
further
well,
in debt.
The country loses money, and the Republicans lose morality.
Uh-huh. Brilliant, Bill. Brilliant. Thank you very much for calling and sharing those both with me. We have the smartest listeners on earth on this show. Jeff in Canton, Michigan, listening to WDTW 1310 AM. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, you know, it's funny. I find the Republicans in a very familiar situation, being a historian and looking back at the Eisenhower years. And you've talked about this before on your show, where coming out of the New Deal, coming out of World War II and into the Cold War, Eisenhower had to aggressively, from time to time, pull his party to the center and tell them to get off of Social Security, to tell them to get off the New Deal, that some of these programs were effective, that they were good programs, that America liked them, and that the only way they were going to hang on to their political presence in America was to accept that they were now permanent. And in a brilliant stroke, you know, Eisenhower, maybe the last liberal Republican, even though I think there's an argument to be made for Nixon, used the Cold War as a liberal tool to build a highway system based on military equipment that could roll on it, build hospitals to take care of injured in case we were attacked.
Right.
Build schools to educate people.
To produce engineers who could come up with new and better weapons. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I am holding in my hand the Labor Day 1956 flyer that the Young Republicans of America put together. Young Republican Labor Committee, 1625 I Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. And the headline has an elephant wearing a kind of a blue-collar clothes, you know, shirt and pants, holding a toolbox, and it says, Young Republicans Support Labor, Labor Day 1956. And I'm reading this verbatim. This is the entire thing. I'm not editing it in any way. The subhead says, America's free working men and women produce more and consume more than any other nation. And then there's a series of bullet points. Greatest prosperity in history without war, over 66 million employed, highest take-home pay in history, greater job security, greater job opportunity, less time lost because of strikes, increased union membership, best working conditions in history, Social Security expanded. And then underneath that, in big letters, it says, attend your union meetings with an exclamation point. And just below that, it says, register and vote Republican. That
and
was
funny because
that was 56.
Yeah. And so my real quick point here is that as much as I think it is appropriate for the Democrats and the progressives to focus on, you know, labor and health care and all these things as moral issues and rights, I really think for a long-term hold on politics in this country, there's going to have to be another more practical association that people can link to. And why not, just like Eisenhower did in the 50s, connect, you know, a working, prosperous, equal America to national security.
Yeah.
That, you know, that as we have a stratified society, we lose control, we lose and become unstable as a nation. And so link that to what is essentially one of the strongest points that Republicans make in political cycles, and that's national security. That's what Eisenhower did.
Yeah, I'm with you, and I think that it would be a genuinely successful thing. So I'm with you. Thank you very much, Jeff. Jerry in Amityville, New York. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, hi, Tom. With respect to what you were talking about a little earlier, about with respect to the so-called fiscal cliff and about Republicans and what they're doing. Well, this reminds me of that old adage or cliche about you giving somebody an inch and them wanting a mile. And this is why I think Democratic politicians should have never put earned benefits such as Medicare so quickly on the table as a sacrificial lamb. I mean, because, look, the president has already made concessions, in my opinion, because going to Tim Geithner, the president...
We cut $1.5 trillion last year. I mean, the president has already done that. We've already had the cuts, thank you very much. And I love your use of the phrase earned benefits. I would take it even farther. I would say earned benefits and insurance programs. Let's start referring to Social Security insurance, Medicare insurance, unemployment insurance.
I don't like calling it insurance. I'll tell you why. Because insurance is something that can be refused. If you put an insurance claim, it can be denied or refused.
Not if you have a legitimate claim.
Well, you see, that's the game the insurance companies play. I mean, if you look up in any law dictionary, entitlement is actually a legal phrase that refers to an absolute right someone has to a benefit, such as Social Security.
I absolutely understand that, Jerry, but it carries with it at the unconscious level. You know, what do you, people who think that they're entitled are generally, you know, viewed as snobs or, Mitt Romney, he feels like he's entitled to everything, you know. He's born with a silver spoon in his mouth. So I personally think that instead of calling these entitlements, we should call them insurance programs. I understand your disagreement. I respect it, and I respectfully disagree. Thank you, Jerry, for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And pretty remarkable. Let's start out by talking with Theodore Beale, a.k.a. Vox Dei, which is Latin for the voice of God. VoxDei.blogspot.com, his website. Christian libertarian, author of several books, including A Throne of Bones, just out today. The blog is Vox Populi, which would be the voice of the people. So, voice of God, welcome.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you with us. You are a self-professed secessionist. Explain this to me.
Well, the way that I would begin it is that I would say that I favor self-determination for all peoples, whether they're American, whether they're Scottish, whether they're Catalonian.
Well, any person, including yourself, can hop on a plane and go to any other country, and if you can get them to take you, you're there.
Well, I am. I've lived in Europe for 13, 14 years now.
Okay. So, you know, what's the problem?
Well, I don't have any problem. It's simply a intellectual thing. It's simply understanding that throughout the course of human history, it is entirely normal for groups of people to come together for a period of time and then break apart after a while. You know, this is a pattern of history that has existed for as long as man has written these things down. In fact, in that new novel that you mentioned, it's based on the Roman Social War of 91 BC, which was essentially a secessionist movement, even though they ended up joining the empire after all.
So you're suggesting, let's translate this into simple English. Are you suggesting that the citizens of any particular state on a majority vote should be able to simply withdraw themselves from the Union as states did in 1860?
Of course. You know, we're seeing it happen right now in Scotland. You know, we think it's unthinkable because America is such a short-lived...
But Scotland has historically been a separate country. And, yeah, I mean, they have profoundly different I spent a fair amount of time in Scotland, and it's a very different culture from British culture. And they have fought wars over the years. I mean, you know, what's his name? The crazy actor, Mel Gibson, made a movie out of one of them. I mean, they fought wars with the British. England historically was a separate country just because they happened to be on the same island. And you could argue that the only reason Scotland was part of the United Kingdom is because they were conquered, and now they're unconquering themselves. That's very different from states voluntarily joining a union like we have here in the United States.
But they weren't conquered. They came together as part of the voluntary acts of union from 1707. Their voluntarily democratically supported union has lasted more than twice as long as the history of the United States. And so we're seeing this all over the world. We're seeing Catalonia, which has been part of Castilian Spain for even longer than Scotland's been part of the United Kingdom, voting, again, democratically, left and right, joining together to vote the secessionists into power.
Right.
And so,
but again, don't you think that that's because they're sick and tired of Spain being part of the EU and thus having lost their national sovereignty? And so they're going to claim their own national sovereignty and withdraw themselves from the EU?
That might be the case with the Catalonians. It's not the case with the Scottish. The Scottish actually want to get out of the United Kingdom and then join the EU in their own right, which
seems crazy to me.
It's totally crazy to me, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the whole point about self-determination is that, you know, what is it to us as, you know, Americans or, you know, whatever we might be.
So you think Lincoln should have just said, you know, when the South seceded, I mean, even before a number of the states seceded after he was elected, but before he was installed into office, because back then the elections were in November and you were sworn into office in March. And during that time, you had a bunch of states that said, okay, that's it, we're out of here, that he should have just said goodbye?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the interesting thing is that before Lincoln, about maybe 30 years before that, the secessionist states were the New England states. They were the ones who were talking about seceding. I don't recall what the deal was, why they were interested, but it was never really questioned, you know, that a state had the right to voluntarily leave the union, because otherwise, if they didn't have the right to voluntarily leave, then it was just another, you know.
But that right is not laid out in the Constitution.
I'm sorry?
That right is not laid out in the Constitution.
Well, no, because the Constitution has to do with the rights of the federal government. It doesn't have anything to do with the rights of the states. Why, if you're writing a document,
well, actually,
the federal
it does.
Government,
it gives the federal government, for example, the right to regulate commerce between the states. It says how states shall apportion their electors. It says how states shall determine the number of representatives they're sending to Washington, D.C. There are a lot of rules for the states.
And those are all things that have to do with the operation of the federal government. It doesn't have anything to do with the operation of the sovereign and several states.
So what about the people?
Obviously, when you join a group, you agree to abide by the rules of that group.
So if Texas secedes and becomes the independent nation of Texas, what happens to those Americans in Texas who consider themselves Americans who don't want secession?
Well, presumably in a democratic country and in a free and democratic country, those people would either have to decide if they wanted to stay and accept it, the same way that the people in America at the time of the Revolutionary War, you know, many of them either moved to Canada or moved back to England, or in some cases they just decided to stay and become Americans. It would be up to them, and presumably the Texans would be focused enough on freedom that they would let those people do whatever it was they wanted.
What is it about the United States? Excuse me. What is it about the United States that, first of all, what state do you live in?
I don't. I've lived in Italy for 13 years.
So you live in Italy right now?
I used to live in Minnesota.
In Minnesota. So you really don't have a dog in this fight. Doesn't that diminish your credibility somewhat in making these kind of statements? I mean, this isn't going to affect you.
Well, no, of course it's going to affect me in a sense in that, you know, I have friends and family there. I mean, I wouldn't say that, you know, would you say about somebody who lived in the States who has family back in Scotland that they have no, you know, of course there's an interest, but my primary interest in this, as in practically everything, is primarily intellectual. You know, am I going to shed any massive tears if Catalonia breaks away from Spain? No. Am I going to be terribly upset if Texas decides to be independent? No. I mean, if you support self-determination for one group of people in the world, you should support it for everyone. And why shouldn't Americans have the same right of self-determination that we support for the people in Libya, for the people in Egypt,
But most of the states who are talking about secession are states that for every dollar that they send to Washington, D.C., they get back $1.10, $1.20, $1.30. Texas gets more federal money in than they send out. So when they secede, first of all the military bases in the state would close, and that's not even included in that equation that I just shared with you. Secondly, everybody loses their Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all those other things. How is that state going to exist?
Well, first of all, Texas is not going to have any trouble existing because Texas is a, you know, would be one of the, I believe, you know, 20 largest economies in the world, 30 largest economies in the world. I mean,
not without federal infrastructure.
Obviously it might not be quite as easy for them, but whether it is or not, that's their right to say. It's not for you or for me to decide. You know, if Delaware, for example, let's take the most absurd example. Delaware would be like, you know, Liechtenstein or something. And now they wouldn't have, you wouldn't think that they would have any business going independent. But if they want to go independent and live in grass huts and that sort of thing, what is that to you or me? I mean, that's what freedom is all about, is allowing people the freedom to make stupid choices.
Well, you make a very compelling and libertarian argument, Vox Day, voxday.blogspot.com. And his new books, A Throne of Bones, and the website Vox Populi. Interesting. I wonder if this is going to be the thing for the Republican Party. Hey, stick around. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Vox Day, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Good talking. 15 minutes past the hour. John in Minneapolis, you have some thoughts on secession?
Yeah, I think it might be a way of solving this fiscal cliff or our deficit problem because, you know, as you said, a lot of these states like Mississippi, Georgia, actually their economy revolves around federal expenditure. They have Air Force bases, they have you know, people in the military. I lived in New Mexico for many years. At per capita income, it was one of the poorest states. The predominant economic industry there was defense. For every dollar that they sent out, they got something like $1.60 back. I live now here in Minnesota, and I think we receive less than 50 cents back. So this might be a way for these secessionist Republicans, you know, I mean, it might be a way for the country to solve this debt problem.
Yeah.
And I think it could be a good way of doing it. I don't know, you know.
Farewell. I just as I said earlier, we don't have red and blue states. We have purple states, you know, more reddish purple and more bluish purple. But we have purple states. There are Democrats everywhere. There are Republicans everywhere. And there are lots and lots of independents everywhere. And I think for anybody to say, I am not an American, particularly somebody who's been living in Europe for 13 years, I don't have that much allegiance to America.
Can I make one more comment?
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, too, his talk about self-determination, I'd like to see that as part of our foreign policy. It would be nice if we practiced that. That came out of the Nuremberg trials, you know, that countries have or people have the right to self-determination of their government. It's just that, unfortunately, it almost never is allowed to exist. And there are people now that want to bomb the hell out of Iran. I've known a lot of Persians in my life. I used to tutor Persians when I lived in New Mexico. There were a lot of people taking classes when I was in school, and I love Persian culture, and I just think it's unconscionable to even suggest that we do that. But yet there are people in this country that just look at Iran as, run by mullahs, and they forget that there are a lot of people there that want to determine, a lot of young people that want to determine their fate and are not allowed to, and we don't allow them. We started that whole cascade by getting rid of Mossadegh in 1952. Yeah. We had the opportunity to allow allow them to have self-determination of their government and control over their oil fields, and the British and ourselves decided that that was just not what we should allow them to do because it's not to our economic benefit. And this has been the history of, you know, since World War II and since we've been part of the world power, that, you know, we are not allowing people to do that.
So I would argue that shift, John, actually happened after World War One. World War One was the end of the British Empire.
Something, unfortunately, that we don't believe in our own ideals, and it undermines us. It just undermines us around the world. I'd love to see self-determination for peoples around the world. I think it's a big moral failing, and I don't know what to do about it.
I think it's one of the fundamental principles of the UN and of the treaties that we signed to be part of the United Nations, and that, you know, other states only interfere in the internal affairs of a state when they're basically killing their own civilians, when it's gotten extreme. But yeah, I understand your point, John. Thank you for calling and making it. Bill in Bourbonnais, Illinois. Hey, Bill.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Secessionists.
I'm really tired of hearing this secessionism. You know, if you don't like living here, leave. If you don't want to be part of the
Well, this guy apparently has. For 13 years, he's been living in Italy.
Well, not that guy, but the rest of them.
Yeah.
If you're living in Texas, you don't like living in this country, you don't like a democracy,
join Theodore in Italy.
Or Italy, yeah. Italy changes the government about every 3 months.
Yeah, and they have a national health care system, by the way.
Yeah, no, so. But I was thinking one day about
socialism.
If we wanted to reduce government, why don't we get rid of the 50-state idea and just have one big country? Just if we could get rid of state governments, that'd be a whole lot of cuts.
Well, I like the idea of state governments, county governments, local governments, the idea that power flows from the bottom up and that at the local level you have a say, that you don't have to reach, you know, all 51% of Americans for something other than the presidency. And
no, we could keep the rest of them, just get rid of the state government.
Yeah, well.
We'll have the county, the local.
I'm wary of that one, Bill. But thank you for your call and your thoughts. Jim in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Jim, what's
up? Yeah, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I was just at the same discussion that the previous gentleman was talking about. Secession, if they want to leave this country, go for it. You know, mm-hmm. The guy that's living in Italy for 13 years, hey, wonderful. Italy is a wonderful country.
He's just the perfect spokesman for the secessionists. He's already left.
Yeah, well, you know, he doesn't have far to go then.
Yeah. So
I mean,
you know,
I've been in Texas and especially East Texas, you know, driving through the countryside over there.
Mm-hmm.
There's more poor people in that state than there is any other state.
Yeah, there is. There are massive swaths of poverty in Texas. There are very, very many poor people. There are also, you know, a fair number of very, very rich people in Texas.
Definitely. There's very wealthy people. But some of those people that want to secede the union, it's like, I don't think they know that they have to leave. If they leave the country, you can't leave this country. Nobody's holding you back.
Yeah.
Get a passport, move on.
Yeah. I just find the whole thing interesting, Jim. I find it fascinating because it's a movement that exists almost entirely inside the Republican Party. And,
oh, yeah, definitely.
And I'm convinced that when people like Vox Day go on talk shows, that John Boehner has to be, you know, it starts the waterworks, you know. I mean, it's just the Republicans have to be looking at this going, this is the death of our party. This is the voice of our party. So it's an interesting time. We live in interesting times, Jim, as the old Chinese curse goes. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to WCPT. Here's a fundamental question. Is advocating secession a form of treason?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And if it is, or if it's even a minor crime, what should be the penalty? Should they lose the right to vote? Should they lose their citizenship? Should they have to leave the country? Viagra for your brain. The Tom Hartman Program does not, however, lead to stiff thinking. And don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some. So, welcome back. Mary, you live in Texas, in Denton, Texas. You're one of those poor people that this guy has been saying, oh, yeah, let him go. What are your thoughts on secession?
I know that we can't afford it. We collect, the federal government collects income taxes from all people in Texas, and then they send more than that back to us.
Right.
In Texas, to have a tax increase, it takes a majority vote of everybody in the state. We aren't going to vote to have an income tax. It's not going to work, which means that a couple of years after we manage to leave, we're going to be crawling right back, and the federal government's not going to have any part of it.
Or you're going to become a third world country.
Yeah, all I know is that they only can meet on in the first 6 months of odd-numbered years, so we all kind of pack our bags in January and we wait.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. Okay, Mary, thank you very much for that, and thanks for the information. Cora in Taos, New Mexico, you think that the secessionists,
I don't think they're thinking, and obviously, and people who don't believe in science or anything like that or mathematics, but they also seem to forget that there are sovereign nations that live among us. And certainly here in New Mexico,
you're talking about Native
American
communities.
Yes, yes. And so, I mean, if anybody has any right to say anything and about their self-government and rights and whatnot, it should be the Native Americans.
Right.
But we also have had problems out here. Like I said, people don't seem to think, you know, when they are unhappy about things and objecting. We've had trouble out here for the past year with Spanish land grants. Spanish land grants.
You mean from the 1600s?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And because New Mexico had a problem where anybody could file a title.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the law was so loose that anybody who is still a member of the Spanish land grant, we had a problem in the middle of town, all the way down to the south end of town, involving, hundreds of businesses and individual owners. And people may laugh at this, but what it did is it clouded everybody's titles. So people could not only not sell their property, they couldn't borrow against it.
Because somebody came along and said, my family was granted this land by Spain in 1670, and I'm reasserting that, right?
Yes. So that was finally cleared up in court, but there's still another one going on in a neighboring community.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. And with regard to the Native American communities, I think one of the things we have to remember, if you say, okay, secession is wonderful, secede from the United States, Native American communities are the largest pockets of poverty in the United States.
Yes.
There are some that are doing fine with, basically casinos, but it's no way to live, and these groups have some really, really serious problems. And it's, it's the obvious consequence of being stuck in the worst places with the worst land by, 600 years of racist and genocidal policies. But it ain't the way to go, I don't think. Cora, thank you for the call, and thank you for a very thoughtful perspective on that. And I didn't know about Spanish land grants. That's fascinating. Dwayne in Petaluma, if we secede, who gets to vote? For what?
No, I was in the process of seceding. Back when the indentured servitude was descending into slavery, prior to that, they had voted to be a state, and then
who's they?
People want in the South.
Okay.
When the Southern states seceded, the question is who was that a proper secession? Who got to vote? The certainly the slaves didn't, and that they didn't have anything.
And the women didn't either.
Yeah, approaching a proper determination of who got to secede. I would suggest that being that the Articles of Confederation were a perpetual union, and they'd agreed to a perpetual union if they withdrew from the United States, they were still stuck under the Articles of Confederation.
Hmm. The Articles of Confederation that defined the Confederacy, not the Articles.
No, the Articles of Confederation that defined us for the first 10 years of our existence and covered our first three presidents prior to Washington.
Right. So you're suggesting that the rationale for secession can be found in the Articles of Confederation, but not in the Constitution. Is that your point?
No, I'm saying quite the contrary. It's quite clear in the Articles of Confederation that it's perpetual union. And the successor as the U.S. Constitution, they didn't follow any reasonable process for withdrawing.
I see. And therefore, there is no process for withdrawal because...
Not at this point,
because
no.
Because the precedent explicitly forbade it, and what with the Articles of Confederation and what followed it, the Constitution didn't explicitly allow it and so implicitly forbade it, which was the position that Lincoln took.
and they didn't have any, most of the states didn't have any process that properly guided the consensus of the population to withdraw. Right. I mean, it was just the slaveholders that wanted to basically run a conspiracy and withdraw.
Well, and a lot of that in the 1860s was about the institution of slavery. I mean, let's just be real about this.
Absolutely. Yeah. Can I make one other point?
You may.
December 23rd is the 99th anniversary of the Federal Reserve Act.
Oh, really?
And people should be thinking about what is the appropriate demonstration, shedding light upon the Federal Reserve on that day, illuminate the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. Take the results of Bernie Sanders' audit and publish it far and wide as a starting point, or kind of point out how these Federal Reserve governors live like kings and how they've got their own budgets and their own private jets and all this stuff. I mean, there's a lot that could be done, and you know that we've lost control of our own currency other than the coins that we mint. Why don't we start? You know, they're talking about minting a $1 coin. Why don't we start minting $10 coins, $20 coins, $100 coins, $1,000 coins? And then the mint can control our currency. It can compete with the Fed for a while and eventually put it out of business. I don't think we even have to just do away with the Fed. We could just simply, you know, have the president. And I believe Congress would have to participate in it. In fact, I know they would. It's one of the Article Section 8 powers. If Congress was to say, okay, the U.S. Mint shall start producing $1, $10, $5, $10, $20, $100 coins, then which are the property of the U.S. government. Coins are made by the Mint. Dollar bills are, you know, this is a very, very strict interpretation of the Constitution. It says mint coins, right, currency of the United States. And therefore, the Federal Reserve notes, the paper that we have in our pocket, that belongs to the Federal Reserve. The silver you have in your pocket, although it's not really silver anymore, belongs to the Treasury Department. And so that would be a way to move back to our own Treasury doing it. But, you know, nobody's got the political will to really push that kind of thing. And nobody's really seriously talking about it outside of, on the left, people like Dennis Kucinich, and on the right, people like Ron Paul. But it's an interesting idea. Duane, thank you for the call. Jerry in Taylor, Michigan. Hey, Jerry. What happens to federal money? I think we were just talking about that.
Oh, Tom, thank you for the soapbox opportunity. And my my comment is the utilities use this term called stranded costs. And that is the cost which the old power poles and installation. So when municipalities want to privatize the utility structure, there's a stranded cost that has to be reimbursed to the utility, which is quite onerous. And now if the states like Texas want to secede from the union, who's going to pay for all the federal dollars in the U.S. interstate system and the massive sewer and water retention projects that have been spent by the people of this country for the benefit of the citizens of Texas? And I think if the federal government could say, well, you know, if you want to secede from the union, I think you should also deposit as a good faith measure some of the costs that the U.S. government has spent upon your state.
Which in today's dollars would be several trillions of dollars.
Well, there you go. Well, then let them go. If they want to pay back that money, well, then, let them go back to Mexico, whatever they want to do.
Yeah, great point. Or go back to being an independent nation. Excellent point, Jerry. Thank you for the call. There's a lot more to this issue than I realized. John in Thousand Palms, California. You say we have two classes of states?
Yes, Tom. I agree with the caller prior to the last caller that most people do not remember that this country did not just come instantaneously into an existence. That 5 years it fought for its independence, and then for 10 years it existed under the Articles of Confederation.
Right. George Washington was actually our fourth president.
All 13 of the original states together.
I'm sorry. Apparently my callers have a hard time hearing me, and I apologize. I spoke over you, and therefore I missed part of what you're saying. Please say it again.
Yeah, I was saying that when the Articles of Confession were first implemented, that is what held the country together for the first 10 years.
Right.
And then the Constitution succeeded it, and under the Constitution there was a whole setup that was arranged for admitting new states, because no new states had been admitted to the Union up to that time. There were only the 13 original states.
That's correct.
Now, I think somebody, the previous caller was saying that that was supposed to be a perpetual union. I'm not sure about that.
He was saying that the perpetual union language was in the Articles of Confederation.
Yeah, I know, and I'm not sure about that. I have to look it up.
Right.
But the thing is that if any states could succeed, it would only be the original 13, not those that were created under our present constitution, because those were all federally constituted states. And so what happened, most places that became states had to become a territory first,
right.
And then they had to prove to the federal government that they had enough people and that they had a functioning government, and then they could petition Congress.
Right.
Now, what's interesting, I'm in California. And California has a very interesting history in that we're the only state that was not first a territory before being admitted to the Union.
Remarkable. John, I we're out of time.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You're going to have to call back another time. You have a storehouse of history, and I genuinely appreciate it. Thank you, John, for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Texas seceded, or Louisiana, or Mississippi, or Oklahoma, or, you know, it's hard to say. Well, you know, would you miss them? Actually, I would. I think that we are a union of 50 states, and frankly, we should be 51 states. Washington, D.C. should have statehood as well, and Puerto Rico is now saying, hey, you know, how about us? So 52 states. So we have to have a contest for how to redo the flag. Anyhow, Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. By the way, our Talk Radio News Service brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. This Christmas, you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. Go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com for more information on that. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true of you.
I think we're both doing better than the fiscal cliff.
There you go. So what's up in the news, Bob?
Well, I've got to note the story, the John Boehner photo snub with the president. And I mention that only because, yes, it's a trite thing, but it's a sign of civility or not in Washington where he's not photographed with the president of the United States.
Yeah, I saw that. For our viewers, I haven't talked about it on the program today. So for our viewers and listeners who don't know what you're talking about, you want to set it up? You want to explain
it? I, like many members, have been to many, many Christmas parties. You go downstairs, you take a picture with the president and the first lady. It's traditional. You do it. Everybody does it. And Speaker Boehner didn't do it and didn't want to do it and didn't want photograph with the president. Now, again, somebody say, well, it might be trite or it's a small thing, but I think it's symptomatic of Washington. I mean, everybody gets this picture taken. It is not a big deal. It's not like it's going to be used for either one of them to endorse each other in
right.
some future election. So
but the symbolism is huge.
That's right. The symbolism is huge. And I know it's a small thing, but I think it says a lot. Right now, frankly, Tom, it would be a time for, you know, Boehner to actually, you know, get that picture with the president or the president to encourage the picture, which the White House did encourage the picture
right.
to happen. And it's not because they're going to use it. It's just another, you know, let's be a little bit more warm to each other to try to communicate. So I think it's a sign of the times.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And a sign of the last 4 years, in fact, ever since Obama came into the White House.
Uh-huh.
And now probably the next 4 years. It seems to me, Bob, and you have a very unique perspective on this, having been a member of the House of Representatives. It seems to me that what is going to happen between now and maybe the first or second week of January is that the Republicans basically, you know, they have no say in taxes going up on the rich. That's going to happen.
That's correct.
But what they do, what they still are holding, the giant club with a big nail sticking out of it that John Boehner's holding behind his back, is the debt ceiling. And he's made it very clear he's going to extract a pound of flesh for that. Do you think that it's possible that the president, by simply saying to the Republicans, okay, tell us what you genuinely want, we're not going to negotiate with ourselves, will force him into saying, okay, I want you to cut Social Security, okay, I want you to cut Medicare, okay, you know, whatever, in such a way that the American people are so horrified that the Republicans may think they're pulling one over on the president, but actually they're killing their 2014 chances?
I think the president can actually ask for the details, and the president, in turn, can be asked for the details. But there are certain things the president cannot do. And frankly, I wouldn't recommend any president of the United States permanently get rid of the debt ceiling. I mean, that...
Well, we never had it in the United States until, I think it was 1954, it was put into law during the Eisenhower administration. And
part of these negotiations, I don't see where Obama can, you know, can do what the Republicans want to do on the thing.
Yeah, but it's basically just a piece of legislation. It could be easily undone.
Well, sure. Yeah, look, I raised the debt ceiling, what, six times under George Bush, I think, alone?
Mm-hmm.
It was a routine vote.
Right.
You voted and you went to dinner.
Well, when a Republican is in the White House, when Democrats are in the White House, then the Republicans scream about it. That was Jude Wininsky's contribution to the Republican strategy in 76, to Santa Claus theory.
But I think that everybody's, Boehner laid out generics. Steny Hoyer, the number two Democratic member in the country, said, hey, that's a start. I mean, I think Steny was trying to extend that, institutional hand out there for encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
But the details aren't there on the Boehner plan.
Right, right.
And if the details are there, the American people might say, oh, we like it. And then they might say, no, we don't.
Well, the only detail, there are some details that Boehner has said he wants to raise the Social Security eligibility age to 67. And
where do the cuts come from?
Well, that would theoretically be a cut, but I mean, most Americans are pretty horrified by that in and of itself.
Medicare issue. There's a lot of more details to these plans, and he's put a starter out there. But Boehner's problem, Tom, as you know, politics internally, like he's getting reamed today because two members were thrown off of a committee, and they're saying it's a conservative conspiracy movement, and it actually wasn't. But so he's got trouble at home. If he wants to present a plan, he negotiates with the president, and then he has to take it to his conference, and it's got to become part of the Boehner plan.
Well, this is, Mike Papantonio was speculating about this earlier in the program, that there's going to be a purge in the Republican Party of the Tea Party crazies out of the committees. Do you think that that's true?
Just two recently, there's been four or five that are gone. Of key committee slots, four or five right now. Now, the Republican leadership is saying, no, it's because they were acting weird or they were against their colleagues or whatever. But the conservatives take it as a purge. Now, it's interesting. They used to purge moderates out of the party.
Right.
And now, all of a sudden, you're seeing some of that. And I think it's because Boehner came in a little bit stronger after this election, and he made a move. And I think it's a move to tell people, look, I may be getting pressure from you, the Tea Party movement, but, we can take some of your people out here. So it's a game of what, chicken,
yeah,
with the Tea Party and Boehner right now, and I don't know who's going to win it.
Well, and Eric Cantor's in this. He's made it very clear that, or I think it's fairly obvious, that he wants Boehner's job. Is his strategy to stab Boehner in the back to do a, et tu, Brutus, or is his strategy to simply outlive him, outlast him, wait until Boehner retires?
I don't think that Cantor, I think he's bright enough to not make a move to stab Boehner. I think he will sit and let nature take its course. Now, he might, grumble under his breath.
Yeah. But you don't think that he's going to, set up things for Boehner? It seems to me
that Boehner's doing a fine job of it himself.
I see. Okay. Bob Ney, I always appreciate your brilliant insights into this and your very unique perspective. Thank you for sharing it with us today. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Back in a second.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the third hour of our program. While Democrats and progressives are focusing on getting out the vote every 2 years, that's all this, we need to get out the vote program. And the White House actually put together a very good one in the unions and all this kind of thing. Republicans, every 2 years, this is conventional wisdom every 2 years. The reality is that it's beyond that. They focus on suppressing the vote. Every single year, year-round, 365 days a year. Less than a month after this last election, Republicans are already looking ahead to 2014 and beyond. For example, Former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu. He was one of Romney's top political surrogates during the election. Earlier this week, he explained to forum goers in New Hampshire why President Obama was reelected. Here's what he had to say. He said, they aggressively got out the base of their base, the base of their base that's dependent to a great extent economically on government policy and government programs. It's basically saying the same thing Romney did. People voted because they got gifts. They voted for Santa Claus. Sununu is pushing this talking point that we're going to hear more and more about over the next 2 years and way beyond that. We've heard similar explanations for Romney's loss from a parade of right-wing talking heads, including Rush Limbaugh, who compared the president to Santa Claus, Bill O'Reilly, who said Democratic voters are just trying to get stuff, and, as I said, Mitt Romney saying, oh, he's just the president's handing out gifts to minorities, women, and impoverished Americans. So, of course, Republicans think that if they could just keep that base of the base, you know, Reagan's fictional welfare queens and their dark-skinned relatives, if they can just keep them from voting, then Republicans will start to win again. But there's something more sinister in the Republican plans. The post-election belittling of Democratic voters as moochers, to use the words of Ayn Rand, has nothing on the pre-election efforts to stop Democrats from voting, period. In the last 2 years, more than 20 restrictive voter suppression laws were passed by Republicans in 17 states, including five battleground states. Voter suppression ID laws, new obstacles to voter registration, and cuts to early voting hours were all put into place by Republican state legislators, governors, and election officials around the country to suppress the vote of working Americans, and particularly of minorities. As Mother Jones uncovered, the most notorious of these ploys, the voter suppression ID laws, disproportionately affect minorities, young people, seniors, and the poor, or those who Sununu would refer to as the Democrats' base of their base. Despite President Obama winning re-election, these laws did indeed have an impact. A post-election poll sponsored by the Heart Research Group and the AFL-CIO found that Democrats and minorities were far more likely to end up waiting in long lines to vote. Obama voters were almost twice as likely to wait in a long line to vote as Romney voters. And African Americans and Hispanics were more than twice as likely to wait in long lines than white voters. This was not a mistake. The thing that Republicans didn't figure on in this election is what effect these kind of laws would have on Democratic voter enthusiasm. Chanel Hardy, the vice president of the National Urban League, explained the surge in African-American voter enthusiasm, saying, we'd been struggling for many years in our communities with how we make the argument that our parents and grandparents had handed down to us, which was, you must vote because people fought and died for you to have the right to vote. She continued, it starts to become a little less motivating the further away you get from those really visceral memories of what it took to get to the polls. But then you bring back a 35-state assault on your right to vote, and it starts getting really reminiscent. All the things our parents were telling us, our grandparents were telling us, have become visceral to this new generation. End of quote. Republicans are hoping that this minority enthusiasm goes away after another round of new voter ID laws in 2013, an off year for elections, so, you know, they think nobody's going to be looking, right? MSNBC reported Republicans now in Montana, battleground states of Virginia, Iowa, and Nevada are gearing up to pass more voter suppression ID laws or make existing laws even more restrictive in the upcoming legislative session. In Wisconsin, this is an incredible story. Over at the Center for American Progress, Think Progress, incoming Wisconsin Assembly Speaker amend the Constitution to allow voter suppression. Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss floated the idea of his state adopting not just a new voter suppression ID law, but actually amending the Constitution. He said, having photo ID is something that's broadly supported by the public and something that I really hope we will have in place by the next general election. Right. That's because a quarter of African Americans don't have voter ID. About a quarter, about 20% of senior citizens don't have photo ID. They don't drive anymore. About 20% of students, college students, don't have photo ID. At least not the kind that these states require. They may have an ID for their college, but in many of these states, they say, yeah, you can't vote with that. You can in Texas vote with an out-of-state carry permit, concealed carry, weapons carry permit, but you can't vote with your student ID. Sorry. Republicans like Sununu sleep well at night because they honestly believe, maybe anyway, that they're protecting the nation from that nearly half of the electorate that now relies on government insurance programs to get by as a result of the damage the banksters caused to our economy in 2007 or 2004 or because they're retired or disabled. They think that if they can just keep poor and minority voters from the polling stations on Election Day, that if they just do that, then Republicans are going to win. And then they can cut loose the social safety net. They can stop government spending to help people down on their luck. They can usher in a new era of Ayn Rand and Paul Ryan personal responsibility. I think most Republicans would probably agree with Ted Nugent, who in the Washington Times recently called for suspending the right to vote of any American who's on welfare. But the real truth here is that Republicans have frankly never been all that interested in democracy. In fact, if you say this is a democracy, they'll get all upset and they'll say, no, it's not. It's a republic. What's wrong with calling it a democracy? From the battles between Jefferson and the Federalists over how our Senate would be elected, to the numerous suffrage rights for African Americans and women that have always confronted fierce opposition from conservatives, more democracy always meant less power for the rich, and that has always freaked out the right. You know, conservative strategist Paul Weyrich, we've played this clip 1,000 times in this program. Back in 1980, he said, I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of the people, and they never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down. Weyrich, by the way, went on to found the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which not so coincidentally authored several of these restrictive voter ID laws passed all around the country in 2011 and 2012. So the point here is that Republicans are not going to rest, not for one day, in their efforts to suppress poor and minority voters in future elections. Senator Barbara Boxer figured this out, which is why she's trying to introduce an election reform bill to put an end to long voter lines by creating federal standards to ensure the polling stations are properly equipped and staffed. That's just the bare minimum. You know, ultimately, patriotic Americans are only going to win this fight when we have a federal right to vote and it's guaranteed for every eligible American. And eligible means working people, poor people, minorities, as much as it means rich Republicans. Federal right to vote will effectively neuter politically motivated state lawmakers and election officials who care less about a robust democracy and more about rigging elections. So no time to celebrate that we won the election because the right is already planning on 2014. They're already trying to reduce the number of voters. This is a 365-day-a-year effort for these guys. It has to be for us, too. We have to pass a constitutional amendment that says that there is a federal right to vote, because our Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore said, no, there is no federal right to vote. So we need to put it into place as a constitutional amendment and shove it in the face. Other metaphors came to mind. Of the Supreme Court. And say, okay, guys, that's it. This is the new law.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So do you think that we could have a national right to vote? I mean, isn't it mind-boggling that the Supreme Court would even say, no, sorry, you don't have a right to vote? It's incredible. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, this is amazing. Nigel Peacock, our webmaster, it was, who I've mentioned, I think, a couple times now here today. He says he was checking out live stream. You know, we have a video live stream of this show for people who don't have a radio station and or a TV station nearby that carries the show. They can pick it up off the web, and we have viewers all over the place. And here's the proof of it. The total number of viewer minutes, and we've only been doing this for like, what, about a year, year and a half, something like that. We had Ustream for a while, and then we moved to live stream. So it's not been very long. Total number of viewer minutes, 51,145,084. And then Nigel says, just for the math geeks, this works out to 852,418 hours, or 35,317 days, or 97 years of continuous viewing of this program. He says, as of this moment, there are 499 people watching live. Hi. So, it's amazing. It's really amazing. Technology, it's just, you know, we live in this just extraordinary time. So Brandon in Gig Harbor, listening on Sirius, you have a way that Texas can withdraw themselves from the union legally?
Okay, so I grew up in Texas. I just moved out here to Gig about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we were always taught from when we were, you know, knee-high to a grasshopper is what we used to say, that Texas came into the union with an agreement that they could leave at any point in time.
Right, that's a myth.
Yeah, I did very little Googling and found the Supreme Court case that kind of backed this up. But I just wanted you to kind of maybe address it for some of the viewers and some of the listeners that haven't heard this. Hopefully somebody in Texas is listening. I know we got a Denton listen earlier. Alicia lives about 20 miles south of there, so hi. But yeah, if you could address this, that'd be great.
So I might be wrong, but my understanding is that the right of Texas to secede from the union being written into its merger agreement with the United States is a total myth, that the document that they had to file with the United States to become a state, it makes no reference to subsequent secession. And, I think, frankly, if it did, that we would be hearing that language being repeated by these people constantly, and nobody ever quotes it. It's, you know, unlike the way that they love to quote the Second Amendment, for example. So probably not. Probably Texas can't secede legally. Vermont, by the way, is the only other state that was also a state before it joined the Union. And there's certainly no provision for secession in the Vermont Constitution or in the Vermont agreement to become part of the union. And I know that from having lived in Vermont 10 years, and we've had a number of Vermont secessionists on our program over the years, particularly back when we started this program in Vermont. In fact, we started it in our living room in Montpelier, and with a connection to a satellite out of Detroit through the IE America Radio Network, and then Air America, and then now Dow Global and Pacifica and Free Speech TV. So I just don't think it's there. Do you know something I don't?
No, not that I don't know of. In fact, there's a history section on the official Texas website that makes mention of it being a myth, but doesn't go into a lot of detail. And the only information that I found is really the Supreme Court case where the Supreme Court said, no, Texas does not have the right to secede. But it's one of those perpetual things that, you're just told growing up there.
Right. And it just never goes away. So then there is not a legal way that Texas can secede.
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
But, that's all you hear about from the Texans is oh, yes, we're going to secede and we can do it. And
yeah,
we're the only state that can do it. And da, 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 da.
Right. Yeah. Well, for all of you listening in Texas, either good news or bad news, Doug, I suppose, depending on which side of the issue. Brandon, thank you for the call. Rodney in Chicago Heights. Hey, Rodney.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
There's a small minority of people, identify them, personally audit their activities and see what goods and services are derived through the federal government, and present them with a bill. And, yeah, here, pay this. You can personally secede and use.
You can no longer.
Use it would be on a pay-as-you-go basis. Option right. two, if you don't want to, pay the bill, well, then you cannot utilize these goods and services. If you can't produce it on your own, keep it on your own property, you do without.
So we charge, if they go to a supermarket and buy food that's been inspected by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, we charge them for that. If they take a drug that has been approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration, we charge them for that. If they travel on a highway or on a road that has been paid for in part with federal funds, we charge them for that.
Yeah. And, and if they don't want to pay, well, then they don't utilize that. But if those two options aren't acceptable, there's a third option.
What's that?
Shut your stupid pie hole.
Okay. Yeah, enough already of the secession talk. Well, I'll tell you, the secession with a quarter of the Republican Party saying that that their state should secede, this is not going to go away. The Republicans are, thank you, Rodney, for the call. The Republicans are just totally doubling down on crazy. Gus in New York, you're listening to WWRL. Hey, Gus, minute to the break. What's up?
Hey,
You know, I was just hearing hot off the right-wing presses a new article that's out saying by Thomas Sowell.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying that if you look at the tax cuts for the rich, that it did increase revenue during the beginning of the Bush administration.
Right.
And the only reason they fell behind in deficits later was because of the mortgage crisis. And I was wondering if you could address that, if it's true, because they say they don't go in the same direction, that tax cuts for the rich and revenue go in the opposite direction.
Yeah, they say the same thing about the Reagan tax cuts. And you know, basically what you see is that when you're in an economy that is growing, tax collections are going to increase over time. And the top marginal tax rate is not the big driver of taxes. The big driver of taxes is things like the capital gains tax rate, the tax rate on corporate income. You've got about a quarter of all profitable corporations, large corporations in America, paying no taxes. That didn't used to be the case. Capital gains are taxed at 15%. They used to be taxed the same as ordinary income. Those are the really big things. So when they pull out that one little thing of the top federal marginal rate, it's pretty deceptive. Thanks, Gus, for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
What that also tells you is that just raising income taxes on the rich is no panacea. And you also have to look at capital gains taxes and corporate taxes and tariffs. Be the good, the bad, and the very, very cadogenously ugly, the good. Elizabeth Warren. It was revealed yesterday that Senator-elect Warren will have a seat on the highly influential Senate Banking Committee, which is probably the worst nightmare wall of Wall Street fat cats. In fact, the finance industry is so afraid of Warren that it spent a whopping $6 million trying to defeat her in the election. With a seat on the banking committee, Warren will be able to help protect the landmark Dodd-Frank financial reform law from being watered down. If I were CEO on Wall Street, I'd be pretty scared right now because Senator-elect Warren is ready and willing to protect the American people from the harmful actions of the big banks and their banksters. The bad. Ted Nugent. Shortly after President Obama was reelected, the conservative rock star called welfare recipients gluttonous, soulless pigs who feast on whatever Fedzilla provides. Well, less than a month later, Nugent is again attacking Americans who have to rely on government benefits to survive. In a column in the Washington Times, Nugent argues that welfare recipients should have the right to vote taken away, writing, "No American on welfare should have the right to vote for tax increases on those Americans who are working and paying taxes to support them. That's insane." The only thing insane here is that Nugent actually thinks people care about what he has to say. And the very, very ugly, Greg Gutfeld. Gutfeld is one of the magical talking heads on Fox News's The Five. On the show yesterday, the group was talking about the Jevon Belcher murder-suicide tragedy. Bob Beckel, Fox's token liberal, broadened the discussion to gun violence in America as a whole, and Gutfeld didn't like that. He especially didn't like when Beckel suggested that thousands of kids are killed every year by gun violence in America. Check it out.
Okay. There were more kids killed in this country than in all...
What do you mean by kids, by the way?
But,
and you should give me an age. Yeah, give me an age.
5 to 17.
What do you think that's from? Why don't you just say what it is? What's a 17-year-old who's killed by a gun? What do you call that, Bob? That's called gang violence. Where does that occur?
Welcome
to Chicago.
That's ridiculous.
Wait a minute. How can liberals lecture about guns but not abortion? You want to talk about kids being murdered?
All industrial countries combined have less deaths for children than the United States.
You say kids, it's 17-year-olds in gangs. Just be honest.
Oh, I see. Every 17-year-old is a gang member. That's who gets killed, right?
But you're talking about gang violence. Where does most of the gang violence occur? In
gangs. I didn't say gang violence.
Look, I'm right on this.
No, you're not. The incredibly ignorant blanket statement Gutfeld made about gang violence in Chicago is bad enough, but apparently he thinks that children dying at the hands of senseless gun violence in America is a laughing matter. That is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Okay, why TPMDC is reporting why insurers are wary of raising the Medicare age. Excuse me, a sneeze there. Republican leaders, you know, John Boehner, Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan long ago suggested this. It's, in fact, the Republicans have voted yes on it twice in the House of Representatives, to raise the eligibility age for Medicare up to 67 and to turn Medicare into a voucher system. The insurance companies, they like the voucher system part because, you know, they get more customers. Although maybe they don't, but they certainly don't like the raise the eligibility age to 67 because that means that insurance companies are going to have to pay for more people between 65 and 67. And that's when people start getting expensive, is in their mid-60s. This is when you start seeing heart attacks and cancer and people falling over dead and stuff. And it's not, you know, it's just not, they're not happy about this. So it may well be that the Republican plan to raise Medicare is going to die at the hands of the health insurance company overlords and masters of the Republican Party. Here's another shocking, this is Amanda Peterson Beadle writing about this over Think Progress. November 24th, you know, 100 people died in this garment factory in Bangladesh. They were making products for Walmart. And they had no emergency exits, no emergency evacuation procedures. Fire happened. All these workers died, most of them young women. In a meeting last year, this is before the fire, last year, Walmart officials decided against agreeing to pay suppliers more so that they could upgrade their manufacturing facilities and pay the cost of safety improvements. In fact, this is from a document obtained by Bloomberg News, a Walmart document. Quote, specifically to the issue of any corrections on electrical and fire safety, we are talking about 4,500 factories, and in most cases, very extensive and costly modifications would need to be undertaken to some factories. It is not financially feasible for the brands to make such an investment. This is like, you know, when, what was it, GM and the side saddle gas tanks on the trucks, or Ford and the Pinto. You know, it's going to cost us an extra $2 a car to make a gas tank that doesn't explode. And with the exploding gas tanks, we'll only have like 1,500, 2,000 people a year die a fiery and gruesome death. And if we pay out $250,000 each on them, you know, that's, you know, only, let's see, $250,000 times 2,000 people would be the same as $500,000 times 1,000 people, which would be the same as $1 million times 500 people. So it'd be $500 million. But we'll save $700 million by not making the gas tanks that way. So since we'll save a couple $100 million, let's not, you know, I mean, we went through this. Ralph Nader exposed this. Congress acted. The gas tanks got safe. But, you know, back apropos of my rant last week, I think it was, about how, you know, and I was using Thomas Jefferson as an example, but there was the entire, you know, James Madison, the whole bunch of the Virginians and the Southern, by and large, Southern members of the early United States who worked on the Constitution, fought in the Revolutionary War. They were slaveholders. They looked their slaves in the eye. You and I are slaveholders, too. And this is the, you know, I'm reading all this noble, breast-beating, you know, chest-thumping by these conservative historians who want to basically try and take down Jefferson. And I get it. He was a slaveholder, and that was a horrible thing. It was hypocrisy. It was a crime against humanity. I'm with you on all that. But the guys who trash the founders who were slaveholders and don't point out that the guy writing this op-ed in the New York Times the other day, it was called The Monster of Monticello. If he doesn't realize that he's a slaveholder, somebody should, you know, like, wake him up. Say, hey, buddy, you own anything that was made overseas? Where were your clothes made? Where was the computer made on which you wrote that op-ed that got published in the New York Times? You think slaves didn't have something to do with that? You say, well, they're not chattel slaves. They're not actually owned by these companies. No, chattel slavery is actually more expensive. Wage slavery is actually cheaper for companies because when people get old, they don't have to care for them. When people are sick, they don't have to pay for them. They don't have to house people. They don't have to feed people. They can throw all those costs on the government, on the social welfare system, on the churches, on charity. on Sally Struthers and Feed the Children. They could throw all those costs there. They didn't have to pay them. But it's still slavery. And arguably a more profitable form of slavery that these modern transnational corporations are engaged in, and that people who write op-eds trashing, and again, I put me at the front of the line to trash the founders for slavery. But to do so without acknowledging that we still have slavery in the world and that the United States would not have the standard of living that we have right now without it is to engage in hypocrisy of the highest order. I was fascinated. This Monster Monticello piece was one of the most circulated pieces in the New York Times. And it was kind of a rebuttal to a piece that I had published a week earlier on Alternet that, you know, talked about how Jefferson fought for most of his life to end slavery. And at the very end of his life was just, you know, sobbing over the Missouri Compromise. I mean, literally, he said, we are creating treason against future generations, against the hopes of the world. You know, he thought slavery would end by 1808 in the United States. And here was 1820-something, and slavery was still going on, 1824, 1827, whatever the year was when the Missouri Compromise happened. A guy who had, you know, spent a lot of effort. And reading the comments, I read the article and I thought, okay, yeah, you're picking on Jefferson for being a slaveholder. I get it. You know, slavery was a horrible and brutal thing. And we are, you know, everybody is totally justified in trashing the slaveholders, slave owners among the founders or not among the founders for owning slaves. I'm with you. But to then ignore the fact that Walmart, this is a document obtained by Bloomberg News, an internal Walmart document, specifically to the issue of any corrections on fire and fire safety. We are talking about 4,500 factories, and in most cases, very extensive and costly modifications would need to be undertaken to some factories. It is not financially feasible for the brands to make such an investment. In other words, we are not willing to put the money forward so that our slaves won't die a fiery and agonizing death. And Americans, by and large, don't give a damn about this because we don't have to look those slaves in the eye. You know, the anti-slavery movement in this country got so intense. John Quincy Adams, after he was president, went back and ran for the House of Representatives just so he could fight slavery. It became so intense, we fought a civil war over it. Because we had to look them in the eye.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And reading the comments on that New York Times piece, I kept looking for a piece that would say to the author, hey, what about your slaves today? Nobody said it. It was astounding.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Yeah, that would be a fine thing. That would be a very fine thing. By the way, public policy polling, they did this poll where they found out that a quarter of Republicans want to secede from the union. Daily Kos helped pay for that, and so they were able to come up with some of the questions. And there was one that I thought was just amazing. I saw it this morning, and I'm scrolling down here to see if I can find it. It was really quite extraordinary. I think it's already scrolled off. Oh, here it is. Here it is. This was amazing. Simpson and Bowles. Okay, who are Simpson and Bowles? Alan Simpson was the Republican senator from Wyoming for a number of years. Now he's just basically a crotchety old retired guy who yells, get off my lawn at anybody who goes near him. Bowles, Erskine Bowles, he was the Democrat. But Bowles was never elected anything. He ran for the Senate twice from, I believe it was North Carolina, 2002 and 2004. And both times the people said, no, don't want you. He was chief of staff for a year or so in the Clinton White House. Big whoop. So why is this guy representing all the Democrats in the country? Well, in part because Obama put him there. But the fact of the matter is that the Simpson-Bowles Commission was not able to produce a report because good progressives like Jan Schakowsky were also on that committee, and they said no to this insanity, like let's cut, you know, Social Security, Medicare, the social safety net, unemployment, et cetera, and let's cut taxes on billionaires and millionaires and big corporations. So, but anyhow, here's the interesting thing. 39% of Republicans, of Americans, excuse me, 39% of Americans say, if you ask them in a poll, do you agree with Simpson-Bowles? Say yes. Now, that's not a majority, it's not a mandate, but here's where it gets really interesting. What Marcos Melitzis or whoever was putting this thing together for the Daily Kos is, I mean, Simpson-Bowles, you had a Republican senator, ex-senator, and a Democrat who worked in the White House. So they put together a similar combination. A Western senator, Senator Burns, and a former Clinton chief of staff, Leanne Panetta. And they, now, Panetta Burns never had a commission. These guys may never have even met, for all I know. But in the public policy polling poll, they asked Americans, do you agree with Simpson-Bowles? 39% said yes. Then they said, do you agree with the Panetta Burns Commission findings? 25% said yes. Seriously, 25% of Americans agree with the Panetta Burns Commission findings, which doesn't exist. So, I don't know. Take this stuff with a grain of salt. I don't know how to say it beyond that. And frankly, the White House should. I mean, it's time to put Simpson-Bowles out to pasture. Erskine Bowles was never elected to anything. The people rejected him twice. He has no business telling us how to run this country. And Alan Simpson is gone from the United States Senate. And they could not get the other 12 or 14 people on that commission. It was either a total of 14 and there was 12 others, or maybe it was a total of 16. There were 14 others. I'm pretty sure it was 12, but whatever it was, they couldn't get a majority of the rest of the people to come around with their wackadoodle point of view. And so they never issued an official report. Mr. Simpson and Mr. Bowles issued a report, but who cares about them? You got a washed up Republican senator and a Democrat who got rejected by the voters twice. And had a job, you know, had a gig with Bill Clinton for a little while. Big deal. Travis in Austin, Texas. Hey, Travis, you have some thoughts on Texas and secession?
My family settled Texas when this was Spain. And, you know, my grandfather's a history teacher. I'm a Spanish teacher. And I will tell you, people don't understand that a lot of part of Texas actually were unionist. My family, such as Central Texas.
You're talking about during the Civil War.
Yes, they were. San Antonio sent troops to the Union.
Yep.
Austin area, because most of these were German, Czech, yeoman type farmers,
mm-hmm.
who did not want to compete with the Anglo farmers who for cotton. Same with East Texas, with a lot of French and Spanish in South and East Texas. They did not like when the Anglos came over and tried to make cotton king, because they were raising,
Travis, I think we just lost you. Okay, we did, Travis.
Oh, did you get me?
That you said they were raising, and then you faded out.
Well, they were raising livestock and other things, and there was a lot of competition against the Anglos who were bringing cotton.
Right, and along with that cotton came slave labor as well.
Yes, exactly. And so a lot of people, like my family, we were unionist.
Yeah,
and we're
no, there were unionists who came from virtually every state. Particularly, you know, many slaves who fled the southern states to join the Union Army. And because, you know, Abraham Lincoln had said, you do that and, you know, we'll make you a citizen and you'll have your rights. So, you know, in part,
yes,
what the Emancipation Proclamation was all about. So
I agree. So when I hear so many of these people talking about good old red, you know, these states, you know, if you really know your history, mm-hmm. you know, we're not as red as we like to think we are.
Texas is purple. Texas used to be a Democratic state. Jack Kennedy put Lyndon Johnson on the ticket with him so that Lyndon Johnson could bring Texas. And he did. You know, Lyndon Johnson was the senator from Texas. It used to be a Democratic state, and I predict within 10 years it'll be a Democratic state again. Travis, thank you very much for the history lesson and for calling. Much appreciated. Sports commentator Bob Costas is taking flack from the right about anti-gun comments, or what perceived anti-gun comments he made on the air following an NFL player's tragedy. Right. Yeah, I'll be challenging Second Amendment supporter and author Alan Corwin about this tomorrow. Plus, my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science Rocks, and the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.